It happened in 1971, possibly the most powerful single act of nonviolent resistance in American history. A guy named Bill Davidon hatched the idea.
He decided that there were two wars going on in the United States at that time, the war in Vietnam and the war against dissent at home. And he just thought it was as important to stop the war in dissent as it was to stop the war in Vietnam. And that's when he finally decided the only way that this can be done is by breaking into an FBI office.
That's Betty Metzger. She got the scoop, and after decades of secrecy, she reveals the full story in her book, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Then, why are bats dying in droves, and what can be done to save them?
Then the reports of this fungal disease began to spread far and wide. Found here in Vermont caves the following winter. And now, only 6 or 7 years into this situation, the fungus is being found killing bats in Oklahoma, Georgia, Minnesota. So it's just spreading far and wide.
That's Don Mitchell. He tells how he got involved in the fight to protect endangered bats in his book, Flying Blind. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On the night of March 8, 1971, eight people broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and stole every file. All were nonviolent anti-war activists, and they were convinced that the FBI was spying on Americans in order to suppress dissent. They found the evidence to back that up in the files they stole. They gave those files to several reporters and to senators. One of the reporters was my guest, Betty Metzger. Then working at the Washington Post, she was the first to break the explosive story of how FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had, for nearly 50 years, been subverting democracy, breaking the law to squash dissent. The burglary was J. Edgar Hoover's worst nightmare come true, because it blew the cover off the rampant criminality of his FBI. It led to groundbreaking protections for democracy, like the Freedom of Information Act. But for more than 40 years, the identities of those who carried out the burglary remained a secret, until the publication of Metzger's book earlier this year. That book is The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Betty Metzger, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
This book, The Burglary, is not just about the now famous burglary of the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. Actually, it was famous at the time, but I think it was forgotten in intervening years. But it is also, as the subtitle says, the subtitle is The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. It's a detailed treatment of the culture of criminal impunity at the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover. So let's start there. Describe J. Edgar Hoover's FBI at the time of the burglary.
At the time of the burglary, Hoover was adored, and so was the Bureau. And Americans didn't know that, in fact, there were essentially two FBIs operating. The one that they knew, which they thought was protecting them from internal and external enemies, but there actually was this other FBI. The other FBI that we learned about, beginning with the burglar, the reason it wasn't known was that Hoover was untouchable. There was no oversight. There was no congressional oversight. His bosses, attorney generals, actually considered him to be their boss, most of them. And presidents didn't exert any oversight. So he really had an absolute freedom, and that made it possible for him to create a bureau that was very abusive to Americans and to stretch the meaning of the word subversive to go all the way from just the mildest expression of opinion that he would punish by creating files on people to outrageous violent acts, even murder that resulted from some of his operations.
Murder?
The case of Fred Hampton is an example. Fred Hampton was a Black Panther in Chicago. And an FBI informer, doing what he was assigned to do, penetrated the group, came to know Fred Hampton and his friends in the apartment where he lived, and drew a detailed map of the apartment, including where Fred Hampton slept, and noted on the diagram Fred's bed. And the FBI informer's diagram was given to a shooter for the Chicago police who came in one night and shot Fred Hampton in his sleep. And what's additionally outrageous about that is that the informer was congratulated by the FBI and given a reward for what he did. That's what I mean by murder.
There wasn't also all that much going after what we could call real criminals. I mean, the real focus was dissent.
The real focus was of a sizable part of what the Bureau was doing, especially in beginning in the 1950s with his movement against communists or anyone who he thought was associated with communists or really just liberal. But by the 1960s and into the 1970s, his hatred of people in the anti-war movement drove much of what was going on.
And I know that anti-war movement well. I was part of it. I started in 1967 with the movement, basically the resistance movement to help young men avoid the draft. You describe that time. Give us a snapshot, a sense of what was going on in that time. What was the mood of the country? What was the mood among young people?
Well, it was a very special time. It's noted for a number of things. For one thing, the country was more divided, I think, than it had been since the Civil War. And the Vietnam War was at the heart of that. Young people had come out, many young people had come out of the civil rights movement into the anti-war movement. And at first, they were optimistic. And not just the young people, but other people, too. People in the United States had really not questioned a war before, questioned government decisions about a war. But this one they did, and asked a lot of questions. And the government wasn't used to that and really saw such people as being, that was inappropriate. And so by the late 1960s, people were extremely frustrated and looking for new ways to gain attention of government officials and to increase the number of people who opposed the war. So it was a time of very strong attitudes. For instance, if you were standing in a line for waiting for a bus, or you were on a plane, strangers next to you might turn to you and ask you what you thought of the war. I mean, the war was part of the national discourse. I think it was almost as though the war became a litmus test of how we judged each other. It just was a very unusual time in American history, and people cared so much about what was happening in that war.
And what about you? What was your position even before you received these files?
Well, I had been a newspaper reporter since 1964, first on a small paper in Pennsylvania, and then in the late 60s, I was at the Evening Bulletin in Philadelphia, and among the beats that I covered the anti-war movement and became very familiar with what was happening during that time, and then I went to the Washington Post at 1970. Yeah.
And as a newspaper reporter, of course, you had to observe the conventions of objectivity, as they call it. But did you have your own perspective at that time?
Well, sure, I did. And I think everybody does. I started out in the early 60s. I was born to be, which was somebody who didn't ask questions and was supportive of the war. And then I remember I was reading more and more, and my own attitudes did start to shift, definitely.
Now, you call this burglary, it was at the FBI offices in Media, Pennsylvania, by a group of anti-war nonviolent resistors. You call it a historic act of resistance. In fact, you say it's perhaps the most powerful single act of nonviolent resistance in American history. I mean, that's a big claim. Why do you say that?
I say that, and I put the emphasis on single act of resistance. I mean, certainly when one thinks of the civil rights movements and the many acts of resistance that Martin Luther King and other people in that movement went through in the late 1950s and 1960s, you think of an enormous impact that eventually changed the nation. When I think of various acts of resistance, I think this as a single act of resistance had more power than any other act of resistance. I say that because it changed one of the most powerful, it made Americans aware of the truth about one of its most powerful institutions, ultimately resulting in reform of not only the FBI, but all intelligence agencies, because the revelations that came out eventually led to both houses of Congress deciding that they must investigate all intelligence agencies. And until that time, this is something that wasn't even talked about. I mean, they caused the first discourse on the role of intelligence agencies in a democratic society to take place. Until then, it wasn't something people even thought about, and it would have been regarded as inappropriate that you let those institutions do what they want to do. They know best, until people found out as a result of the media files.
A very salient point to make at these times when we are taking up these issues once again.
Exactly. Yes, and I think that it's 43 years since their burglary and revealing this information to the American public. We've gone through many changes since then, and I think that the impact of 9/11 probably has made Americans as reluctant to question intelligence agencies as nearly as reluctant as they were back then prior to the media burglary.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Betty Metzger. She's the author of The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Now, tell us who the burglars were. They were part of a nonviolent Catholic left, very involved with the peace movement, but not all of them were Catholic. Give us the broad view, and then I'm going to ask you about Davidin and about Bonnie and John Raines.
Well, that's right. They were involved in the peace movement, had finally, most recently, become deeply involved with people in the Catholic peace movement, although only one of the media burglars was a Catholic. There were eight of them. Keith Forsyth and Bob Williamson were both very young at the time. They had both dropped out of college specifically in order to spend as much time as possible protesting the war. It's hard for people today to realize that that kind of thing happened, I suppose. But there were many young people who felt so strongly about the war that they decided to almost make it an occupation to work against the war. Keith was from a small town in Ohio, had been a student at Worcester College, and came to Philadelphia because he heard that the Quakers were there and there was a vast peace movement, and he worked as a part-time cab driver. Bob Williamson was from a small town in New Jersey, gone to a Jesuit school. He was the Catholic in the group, St. Joseph's in Philadelphia. And at the time of the burglary, was working part-time as a social worker for the state of Pennsylvania. And then there were two burglars. There were eight altogether. I eventually found seven of them, and five of them agreed to be identified, but the other two also told their stories to me. They just didn't want to be identified, and I call them Ron Durst and Susan Smith. Ron Durst was in his mid-20s at the time, a graduate student preparing for a health profession. His motivation for the burglary, I should say the youngest members of the group, their motivation was simply from the war itself, because they had no experience with the civil rights movement. But for Ron Durst, his parents were Holocaust survivors, and he had grown up hearing countless stories about his relatives who were killed during the Holocaust, people he would never meet. And he was infused with the idea of never again, And then as a young man in his 20s, and he became involved in the anti-war movement, he applied that also to Cambodian people, Vietnamese people, and that never again must there be such a conflagration where so many people would die. And Susan Smith was a college professor in the Philadelphia area, now retired. She had a very traumatic experience after the burglary. She was one of the four people who went in through the FBI office that night and in the dark filled suitcases with files. And shortly afterwards, probably not much more than 24 hours later, became obsessed with the question of whether or not she had removed her glove during the burglary. And she could never be sure. She would walk through everything she had done, and she would think she had, no, she had not removed her glove. And then she would think, oh, no, I did. And she lived with that for at least a couple years, just almost on a nightly basis, being afraid that she had removed her glove and therefore left fingerprints. As it turned out, none of them had removed gloves, and there were no fingerprints, but she had no way of knowing that. And then John and Bonnie Raines, the people you said that you would ask me about, John and Bonnie Raines were a couple, and they both participated in the burglary, and at the time they had three children under the age of 8. Even at that extreme time, when many people were engaging in resistance, it still was a very unusual thing for a couple to do such a thing together. They did it because they had developed what was a fairly unusual commitment, and that was that in the case of great injustice, they wanted to be willing for both of them to fight that injustice through whatever effective nonviolent means might come along. And I thought this was such a time and incident. And they had this very strong belief that because parents sort of took a pass on the basis that because they were parents, they couldn't participate in a very deep way in political activity. They thought that because so many parents did that, a rather large number of the population was not participating in such struggles at any given time. And they thought that that was a cop-out. And they made arrangements for their children to be raised by John's brother in the event that they were arrested and went to prison for many years.
And it's a remarkable story. You haven't told us yet about Davidon, who actually was the one who hatched the plot.
That's right. This never would have happened without the insights and great ability to plan of the leader of the group, William Davidon. Bill was a physics professor at Haverford College, and he was involved in many aspects of the peace movement in Philadelphia, scientific arms of the peace movement, student groups, Episcopal. He was a secular Jew who had grown up in the same part of Newark that Philip Roth grew up in. But by 1969, he was looking for more aggressive ways to protest nonviolently. And he was very concerned about the futility that people were feeling. And he found hope with the Catholics because they also were looking for more aggressive nonviolent means and were raiding draft boards in poor communities in the hope of actually making it more difficult for those draft boards to operate. And then in 1970, he started hearing more and more people in the peace movement talking about there being spies in their midst. And he didn't believe it. I mean, his personality and his training were such that he didn't believe in speculating and he didn't believe in conspiracies. And he thought that people were just so disappointed from the war continuing that they had lost their focus and they were imagining this. But then he kept hearing it, and he also saw what a poisonous atmosphere was developing and that some people were dropping out of the peace movement because of their concern about informers. And by early fall of 1970, he really believed it was true. And he thought this is a problem that must be solved. I mean, it was the kind of problem most people would think was too big. Who can force the FBI to reveal whether or not it's suppressing dissent? But he decided that there were, in essence, two wars going on in the United States at that time, the war in Vietnam and the war against dissent at home. And he just thought it was as important to stop the war in dissent as it was to stop the war in Vietnam. And that's when he finally decided the only way that this can be done is by breaking into an FBI office. And the reason for that was he just thought that if the American people were presented with documentary evidence, even though they idolized Hoover, that this would make them realize that something was wrong. They wouldn't want dissent to be suppressed. But he thought that the evidence was necessary and that there was no way that you could get that except by breaking in.
And we're talking with journalist Betty Metzger about her book, The Burglary. And it wasn't just about surveillance, as you point out. It was about the suppression of dissent. In fact, what they found is that the FBI had a very conscious policy of creating paranoia, a paranoia I remember very well because, I assumed, like everybody else who was in my SDS chapter, that, you know, that we had informers among us.
That's right. A lot of people in movements and people in the civil rights movement also felt that way. I mean, did you also feel that that it was a destructive element in your organizations?
Of course we did. On the other hand, we were young and we believed passionately in the correctness, the rightness of our cause. So we didn't let it stop us, I think partly because we really weren't aware of the very real consequences that it could have for us personally. That was only an abstract understanding.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. I mean, actually, in the 50s, a lot of students and teachers really learned, but it didn't get publicity. It wasn't actually named because so much of it happened in secrecy, where FBI informers' files were presented to HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and to various boards that examined un-American ideas around the country, and many educators had lost their jobs, which is an illustration of the damage that can occur in such an environment.
That is so true, and actually I did discover that my name came before the House Un-American Activities Committee. That was after I went to Cuba. But my own situation aside, I mean, this was huge issue. In fact, if it hadn't been for the burglary, the program of the, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO and the Security Index, which was something I actually didn't know about until I read your book, they were discovered. So tell us about COINTELPRO and why this burglary was so important in revealing the existence of this program.
Yes, that is very important. If I may add something else, just among the files that is found in the media office also, and this was not COINTELPRO, but it was huge, was the truly blanket surveillance that was taking place in black communities all over the United States. And I don't think that Americans today really understand or know that that kind of thing happened, that there was a policy that every FBI was supposed to have an informer who reported to him regularly on what black people were doing. And in Washington, D.C., throughout the 1960s and into the 1970s, every agent had to have six. And in the files, it actually described where this surveillance was supposed to take place. And it was simply every place that a person could be expected to go in their normal activities, like the corner store, their church, their library, their bars, restaurants, classrooms, it just anywhere. And no other part of the population, I think, had experienced blanket surveillance the way black people did. You mentioned COINTELPRO was very important. It was exposed as a result of the media burglary, although those of us who received the file on which the term was used didn't know what it was. It was a mere label on a cover sheet. instructions as to where a given file was to be placed. And a little more than a year later, another reporter, Carl Stern at NBC, saw it and thought, what a strange thing, especially the instructions at the bottom that instructed FBI agents to distribute the file, an article about how college administrators should control people who were protesting against the war, to give it to friendly college presidents and to write letters, anonymous letters, mail it to college administrators who were not friendly to the FBI. And he thought that's such a strange thing for the FBI to be doing. And thanks to Carl's persistence and curiosity, by the end of 1973, we had the first information about this, what COINTELPRO was. And it was probably Hoover's meanest and worst operations. They were dirty tricks that were meant to neutralize and destroy individuals and organizations. And they were neither law enforcement nor intelligence gathering, nor did they lead to the prevention of crime. They were secret harassment, dirty tricks carried out by the FBI against his perceived enemies. And I suppose one of the best known ones to the public is the secret attempt to try to convince Martin Luther King to commit suicide.
Right. And I have to say, shades of this have been coming up in recent revelations by Edward Snowden's files that he released, that now the NSA is the one who is doing dirty tricks using the internet to smear its so-called enemies.
That's right. I think that most of the reporting has been about the collection of metadata, which has its own very serious problems in terms of the implication for individuals, where they collect all the data about who we're calling, where we're calling, when we're calling. They say not the content, but the content is saved. But I think lost in all of the discussion of the metadata has been the fact that also the NSA is focusing on individuals going into their computers and smearing them with other people and with false information, as well as observing them in personal exchanges.
We haven't yet talked about your receiving these files. You were one of the first to receive them, probably because of your work covering the anti-war movement, as you said, in Pennsylvania. What was your reaction when you first got them?
Yeah, you're right. I was the first to receive and the first to write. Five people received them simultaneously, three journalists and two members of Congress. And everybody else gave the documents back to the FBI. And that's partly explained by the fact that this was an unusual time, and including in journalism, because this was the first time, it's 3 months before the Pentagon Papers, so this was the first time that a journalist had ever received secret government files that had been given to them by sources outside the government who had stolen the files. So it posed a particular ethical, legal concerns with Catherine Graham, the publisher of the paper. My first reaction when I received him, I was surprised. This was 2 weeks after the burglary. There had been very little reporting on the burglary, so few people were paying any attention to the fact that an FBI office had been burglarized. And the first document I saw was the one that said was an instruction to agents to behave in such a way that they would, quote, enhance the paranoia and make people think that there's an FBI agent behind every mailbox. And that certainly attracted my attention. It seemed quite striking that such a goal or philosophy would be reduced to writing and placed in a file, so much so that it almost seemed like it might be a hoax. But as I read on and I read about college campuses nearby in the Philadelphia area and black activists whose names were familiar to me when I was a reporter, I realized that they probably were real. And of course, the FBI wanted to keep us from publishing them, and so they quickly confirmed that they were authentic, and then spent the rest of the day trying to prevent their publication, with the Attorney General John Mitchell, who would later serve time in prison in connection with Watergate. On that day, the day I received those files, he spent a lot of time trying to convince the Washington Post not to publish any story about them. He claimed that they would endanger national security and lives, which is a very serious claim to make, but we could tell from what we had in our hands that was not true. And matter of fact, I learned later when I read the 34,000-page investigation of the burglary that he had neither read nor been briefed on the files and really didn't know what he was talking about when he made that claim. So Katharine Graham didn't want to publish, and the company counsel also recommended against publication. But two editors, Ben Bradley and Ben Bagdikian, very much believed that this was important information for the public to know about its most powerful law enforcement agency, and did convince her by the end of the day. And by 10 o'clock that night, she made a decision to publish, and it was on the front page the next day.
Yeah, and thank God for that. I mean, in fact, there was a fellow reporter who you invited to go with you to view the files, and then you were very surprised by his reaction and realized that he would not be the right person to go with you, and in fact, you decided not to go. Just very briefly, talk about the press, and then and now.
Well, the press was in a period, a sort of dramatic transition at that time. When it came to intelligence agencies, it's safe to say that there was almost no original reporting about intelligence agencies. People did not have inside sources who were giving them information, except in the FBI, there was this very large public relations operation that was eager to deal with the press, but they had a certain stable of people labeled as friendly journalists that they fed information to on a continual basis. But there was only one reporter, and that was Jack Nelson at the Los Angeles Times. He was about the only journalist who was writing anything that raised any kind of critical questions about the FBI. But that was changing. And then with the Pentagon Papers, and probably more notably with the Watergate hearings, and learning from the hearings and trials of President Nixon's manipulation of intelligence agencies for political purposes, plus the knowledge of COINTELPRO, that was changing the press's attitude. And then a big reform that happened, and I think in the end the most powerful and important one, the strengthening of the Freedom of Information Act in 1974, that really made a great deal of difference. Then reporters and scholars started filing for FBI files, and it was much more likely that they were able to get them as a result of the strengthening of that law. And as a result of that, the true history, the accurate history of the FBI started to be written for the first time, because before then, we only had Hoover's version of things. There was no access to original files, and now there was, and that really made a great deal of difference.
And the struggle continues today.
That's right.
Well, we've run out of time. This is just a fascinating book. I highly recommend it to all our listeners. I mean, we haven't even talked about the burglary itself, the details of that, which are just, you know, such a page-turner. Your book is The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI, and I want to thank you. It's been just such a privilege to talk with you today, Betty Metzger.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Journalist Betty Metzger. Go to writersvoice.net to hear a web-only excerpt from our interview where Metzger talks about a colossal blunder committed by the FBI during its investigation of the burglary that left the FBI with some serious egg on its face. Next up, we talk about bats and buckthorn. Stay tuned after the break.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore. For I killed my my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Don Mitchell wants you to love bats, but he realizes it may take a bit of a learning curve. He had no affection for them when, in the summer of 2006, wildlife biologists working for the federal government asked him if they could trap bats on his Vermont farm as part of a bat protection program. A former anti-authoritarian hippie turned writing professor and sheep farmer, Mitchell wasn't sure he should trust the government. But there was some money in it for his cash-strapped farm, so he decided to go along. Over time, he got to appreciate the little critters and how endangered they are. He also learned some important lessons about nature and our relationship to it. Mitchell's memoir is Flying Blind, One Man's Adventures Battling Buckthorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats. I started out by asking Don Mitchell what brought those three things in the title of his book together.
In the summer of 2006, some wildlife biologists working for the government asked if they could attempt to trap bats on our farm. And I said, I don't care if you want to trap bats, but don't get me involved because I'm no fan of bats. And they had a very successful night, and in fact, they trapped a couple of Indiana bats, and these have been on the endangered species list since the very first endangered species list. And a year later, I retired from 25 years of teaching, among other things, creative writing at Middlebury College, and was casting about for new projects. And I learned that because Indiana bats had been trapped on the farm, I could enter into a contract with a government program, an authoritarian government program, to play the authority card, that would pay me a small amount of money and provide me with some expertise to enhance the habitat in the woods where bats had been found. There are things that a land manager can do to reshape a forest on behalf of any particular species once that species' habitat desiderata are understood, and in the case of the bats, there was an expert who knew what to have me do to make the trees in the woods more desirable for bats to roost in. But it meant dealing with this government agency whose acronym, interestingly, is WHIP, W-H-I-P, and stands for Wildlife Habitat Incentive Project. But acronyms, you know, carries subtextual meanings as well, and this certainly, a program called WHIP was not about fostering a caring and humane relationship between humans and the natural world, and they weren't about fostering a caring and humane relationship with me as their lackey, and that raised all kinds of issues with authority that I'd had throughout my life. My father had just recently died. He had been a profoundly authoritarian figure, and I was trying to process and interrogate that relationship. So now I've talked about the bats and authority. The first term of the subtitle, Adventures Battling Buckthorn. Well, buckthorn is an invasive species that is taking over much of the Northeast in the same way as kudzu has taken over much of the South. It's called an exotic or an invasive, doesn't belong here, was introduced in a thoughtless way, and is now causing substantial ecological damage in forests in the Northeast. And as a condition of the contract to help the bats, I was required to eradicate several acres of buckthorn, as well as some other invasive species that were in the woods. And it was one of the most mind-numbing, dementing, stupid work that I'd ever had to do. I spent hundreds of hours, much of it on my hands and knees, battling invasives like buckthorn, which had nothing to do with bats, really, but it was a requirement of the contract with this authoritarian government agency.
So you were none too fond of authority to begin with, but you quickly found when you first started the farm that the government was, you know, something you wanted to make your peace with, because there were actually a lot of government programs that helped you do what you wanted to do. And you started out sheep farming.
Yes, and we still do raise sheep, although on a smaller scale than we used to. And there was, at that time, in the 1970s and 80s, there was a government price support program for wool. Well, there are many, many commodities in agriculture for which there are government price support programs. Milk, wheat, corn, you could just go down the list. But wool happened to be one of them at that time. And we learned that that the government was not just willing but eager to pay shepherds or sheep farmers more money for their wool as an incentive payment than the wool was worth in the open marketplace. So that was a factor in our choice to raise sheep.
Then the price dropped out of the global wool market. You no longer got supported. I guess that was because there was a whole lot of sheep now coming from New Zealand and Australia, and the market.
It had to do with the demise of the Russian Empire, and the Soviets had been a major purchaser of wool from Australia.
That's
and
right.
They stopped doing it around 1991. And there is so much wool in Australia that the government had built substantial warehouses to stockpile tens of thousands of tons of wool that, if it were put on the market, the world market price would have dropped. And after the Soviets stopped buying Australian wool, the cost of keeping all that product off the market became prohibitive for Australians, and they opened the warehouse, and the world price of wool dropped to where the market value of the fleece of a sheep for 1 year was about 70 cents. And it's going to cost at least $3 to have somebody shear that sheep in the first place. So it became a losing proposition, and there was no longer any rationale for the U.S. government to have a price support program for wool. But these things happen all the time. The government sets up programs. Some people benefit for a while. The program changes, the conditions change, and things move on.
And you and your wife moved on. You both got professional jobs. But then, fast forward again now, you told us a little bit about how you came to invite the government back to your property, this time to create healthy bat habitat. Now, bats are pretty endangered. Well, as you said, there was an endangered bat, the Indiana bat, but bats in general have been suffering from a devastating fungal disease,
white-nose syndrome.
Yeah.
White-nose syndrome, yeah. First discovered in the winter of 2006-07. White-nose syndrome was first discovered in a bat cave near Albany only a few months after the government wildlife biologists had trapped Indiana bats here on our farm. And at first, no one knew what was going on, but they knew that they could see that there were far more dead bats lying on the floor of this cave near Albany than there ought to be in the winter. So in some way, the fungus, which thrives in the cave environment, was causing bats to die. These bats in the Northeast, they spend the summers living in the daytime in trees, in forests, and hunting insects at night. And they are killing machines. So a single bat can kill several thousand insects in the course of the night, many of which happen to be mosquitoes, which has some consequences. In the winter, they go to caves that get down to about 38 degrees but do not freeze, and they hibernate to get through the winter. And the bats were dying in their caves. It had something to do with this fungus. And as research began to be done, it's been discovered that the fungus causes kind of like a skin irritation, like eczema, on the bats' body surfaces. And so they wake up from hibernation and begin to fly around their caves because they just can't get comfortable. And once they start to fly around the cave in the winter, they quickly burn up the precious supply of fat that their bodies laid down to help them get through the winter. So they're dying of starvation based on a skin irritation that the fungus causes. Then the reports of this fungal disease began to spread far and wide, found here in Vermont caves the following winter. And now, only 6 or 7 years into this situation, the fungus is being found killing bats in Oklahoma, Georgia, Minnesota, 3 provinces of Canada. So it's just spreading far and wide. And there's no really direct way to beat the fungus in caves, because that's where it loves to grow. In any infectious disease scenario, the most vulnerable parts of the population get taken down right away, the young, the old, the sick. And eventually, we could be talking about tuberculosis or smallpox or anything. Eventually, the population gets winnowed down to some individuals who either have some natural resistance or have some behavioral strategies that allow them to cope with the disease. So that's what's been happening with bats. 3 or 4 years ago, you just didn't see a bat here in Vermont. And now we do see them again. So the individuals who could deal with the fungus have survived and are now procreating and hopefully passing on their resistance, whatever it is, to their progeny. So the idea of trying to enhance the summertime habitat in the woods, this does not affect white nose syndrome directly. But if the bats are going to bounce back, they're going to need to have high-quality habitat in the summertime, which is when they give birth. Incredibly, it was discovered about 4 years after the first noting of white nose syndrome in Albany, New York, that this same fungus is endemic in the bat caves of Western Europe.
We're talking with Don Mitchell about his book, Flying Blind, One Man's Adventures Battling Buckthorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats. Why aren't the bats in Western Europe affected by it, and how did it get over here?
Well, there are two main theories as to why it doesn't kill bats in Europe. And one is that the fungus and the bats may have co-evolved millions of years ago, so that the situation of discovering who has resistance is taking place in North America may have taken place in Europe so far long ago that all the bats now have that resistance. Another hypothesis, and to me one that is more tantalizing, is that the European bats have been discovered to have certain behaviors that may allow them to coexist with the fungus. Specifically, they've been found to rouse themselves from hibernation every couple of weeks. But rather than start flying around their cave and burning up their fat reserves, they simply do some careful grooming. They clean up. They keep the fungus's growth in check. And maybe if and when North American bats discover those behaviors, maybe that's why some are surviving. Perhaps they've, found those strategies. It's very tantalizing that the fungus first showed up in North America in a show cave, which means a cave which is a tourist attraction. You can buy a ticket and go down there. It's called Howe's Cavern, and it's been a show cave, a tourist attraction, since the 1840s. In all likelihood, somebody had been caving, spelunking, in Western Europe and gotten the airplanes, flew to New York, went to this cave outside Albany, and still had some spores of the fungus on their boots or on their jacket. And so a population that had had no experience with this fungal infection was suddenly exposed to it. And then the bats may well have spread it among themselves, but they also may have been aided and abetted by recreational cavers going from cave to cave and unwittingly carrying spores of the fungus from one cave to another.
A case of loving nature to death.
Yes, and as a consequence, a great many caves that these spelunkers love to go to have now been placed off limits. And that has them up in arms because they enjoy their sport.
Now, as part of creating a home for endangered bats, what can people do to help bats in the Northeast and elsewhere kind of weather this terrible fungal storm? You're making your place better bat habitat, but what are the threats to bat habitat and what can people do about that?
One thing anybody can do if they have a backyard is purchase or build an artificial bat house and erect it. And in doing so, I think you want to get the best advice you can about where to set it up, because the bats have very specific habitat requirements for their summer roosts. Working with the hickory trees in the woods here, the goal seems to be a contradiction in terms, but actually it's not. The hickory trees need to have direct sunlight on the trunk so that the bats stay warm. The bats crawl up beneath shingles of bark that this particular tree exfoliates. But they also need to have connection to surrounding forest canopy, direct connection, at least some. Otherwise, when the bats emerge at night to go hunt insects, they're apt to be picked off by an owl or a hawk or some other creature that predates upon bats. So these twin goals of direct sunlight and connection to surrounding forest canopy, it takes somebody who really understands bat behavior and bat psychology to walk in the woods with me and identify which trees to remove and which trees to save to enhance the habitat. In the same way, just putting up a bat house in your backyard anywhere is not going to do the trick. It may attract wasps or hornets, but it may not attract bats. Again, you're looking for that combination of direct sunlight, but also connection to some shade or canopy. So that's one thing people can do if they have a backyard. The best thing we can all do for bats, I think, is to give them a better public relations firm. Because, I mean, this is a matter of the attitudes to which we all bring toward this creature.
Mm-hmm.
And in our culture, we train children to be afraid of bats at an early age. Part of Halloween is about inculcating this fear of bats. And, you know, you don't want to have a bat in your house, but when you see a bat flying around in the dusk or in the dark, you shouldn't be terrorized by it. You should welcome its presence, because it's doing us a service by killing mosquitoes.
Right. In fact, I live in an area where, they're spreading pesticides all the time to control West Nile virus, mosquitoes of West Nile virus. It's a serious problem.
Right. There are several diseases that are of grave consequence to human beings in which mosquitoes are vectors.
And you say bats are pretty good killing machines.
Yeah, but I think that the direction my mind was going in was to say about 1% of bats at any given time are thought to be rabid.
Yes, because people are afraid.
Rabies is also a disease of great consequence to human beings.
Right, of course.
So you want to admire and respect the bat, but keep your distance.
And how can you tell if a bat is rabid?
I'm not sure that I could identify that behavior,
mm-hmm.
but I know that the wildlife biologists who come here from time to time can identify it, and they've all been vaccinated for rabies. And if they catch a bat, they trap bats in these enormous nets, 30 feet long, 30 feet high, made of some gossamer fabric that the bats can't detect until they get caught. And then the biologists lower the net, extract the bat, give it a health exam, identify the species, weigh it, and so forth, and then turn it back into the environment. But I know I was watching one night, and a bat managed to bite its way through the latex glove that the biologist was wearing and draw a drop of blood. And that bat had to be set aside in like an isolation booth and observed for behavioral signs of rabies. And if it did appear rabid, then it would have to be destroyed, that bat, and tested. And if the test was positive, then the guy who got bit would have to have a whole other series of vaccinations.
Because rabies is almost invariably fatal. Now, your battle against invasives, you talked about buckthorn. One of the things that the government recommended that you use to combat buckthorn was glyphosate. What is glyphosate?
Not just the government, but Vermont's chapter of the Nature Conservancy.
Oh, you're kidding, really? Well, I mean, I'm saying really because I know glyphosate is a pretty toxic chemical. It's been, in fact, has been, I believe, implicated in colony collapse disorder of bees. What was your reaction when you were advised to use it?
My first reaction was get out of town. Glyphosate was invented or discovered by Monsanto maybe 20 years ago, and it inhibits an enzyme reaction that is fundamental to plant growth. And it's typically used as a foliar spray that kills everything that it lands on. But for this particular use, it's not indiscriminate. If you just cut down a buckthorn tree with a chainsaw, it will grow back invariably by sprouting from the root system. If you cut down the buckthorn and then paint the top of the stump with glyphosate product at a pretty strong concentration, during the fall of the year when the plant is already moving nutrients from the leaves and branches down into the roots, then the glyphosate is sucked down into the root system and the plant dies. And the government program assured me that if I did not do this, that my chances of success against the buckthorn were nil. And then I was going to have to pay them some money for wasting their time. So that was something of an incentive to give it a try. And at first I was terrified of working with this stuff. But now I hold with the Vermont chapter of the Nature Conservancy, what else are you going to do with this to kill it? And it needed to be killed.
So you feel that basically, you had to do your dance with the devil. You did it as safely as possible. And has it, in fact, eradicated the buckthorn?
Yes, in the areas where I applied it. I came to recognize it as a practical matter. If I wanted to kill the buckthorn, this would work and nothing else really would.
And yet, you know, the buckthorn itself was introduced by human beings. I think it just kind of highlights how once you start messing with nature, you're not necessarily going to have, you know, remedies that are friendly to nature to combat it.
Right. And that's one reason why the book is called Flying Blind. That's a potent title that has several metaphorical resonances throughout the book. But one of those resonances, one of those meanings is that as human beings, we're never flying blind more so than when we try and re-engineer the ecosystem on behalf of one narrowly defined goal or another. In this case, okay, we're helping bats now. As a corollary, it means trying to eradicate a whole bunch of other plants that really want to grow here. And in 10 to 15 years, we'll have some other set of purposes or desiderata. We don't know what we're doing, really. And our track record for being successful at this kind of ecosystem reengineering is pretty dismal.
Yes, and one shudders even more when one thinks of the geoengineering that's being contemplated to combat climate change.
Yes.
Author Don Mitchell. He's a novelist, essayist, and former screenwriter. In addition to Flying Blind, he's the author of the novel The Nature Notebooks and a guidebook to Vermont in the Fodor's Compass American series. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.